Welcome back to Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan. I'm very excited to share with you this episode with somebody who has achieved everything there is to achieve, really, in British and world speedway. He has been the British under-21 champion, the European under-21 champion, twice British champion, Premier League Riders champion, overseas champion. He's even been the South African champion, and he's been world champion. One of the legends of British speedway, certainly a legend of the Bradford Dukes, and somebody that I watched week in, week out, going to Oddsall, and he's got so many great stories to share with us, and it's going to be a great hour or so, because he's also going to choose his all-time 1-7 and create his own dream meeting as well, and of course not least talk us through that 1992 season where he climbed to the pinnacle of world speedway. And welcome along then to Humans of Speedway, the first world champion to make the podcast. It is Borough legend, Gary Havelock.
Woohoo! First world champion, yay!
I know. Well, Egon Muller was going to do it, and then he's gone quiet. So,
See, Mr. Boy, he knows.
Anyway, here you are. So, good times. How are you anyway? 2020 has not been the greatest year speedway-wise, I think it's fair to say, but what have you been up to?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, I obviously got the gig with Paul as sharing the team manager job with Midlaw. Probably around about Christmas time, and so I thought, well, January and February, I'm just gonna hibernate, because it's always cold and miserable up here in January and February. So I thought I'm gonna hibernate, not go out, try not to spend any money, try not to do anything. So I had 2 months of lockdown before everybody else had it. But everything's good. Yeah, still breathing.
And you mentioned that job with Poole. Obviously, you would have been looking forward to that. And what sort of plans did you have? I mean, and with Poole as well, there's been the situation with the stadium too. I mean, is there any sort of further update you've heard on what's going on there with regards next year?
No, there's nothing. That I've heard any more than what's been put out in the press. I think going back to the job in the first place is when Matt called me, he sort of caught me by off guard. I wasn't expecting him to say what he said by a long shot, you know. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, what? I said, yeah, I'll do it. And he was like, well, I haven't told you about it. I said, we haven't even talked about money yet. And I was like, don't mind, I don't care, I'll do it. Because to me, it was I've been set around for a couple of years, twiddling my thumb, was not doing that, you know. And when you see Speedway on the telly from British racing all the way up to GPs, and I watch the Polish League a lot, and I see a lot of people, you know, have got a lot of jobs in Speedway, and I'm sat on the sofa twiddling my thumbs, but that's the way it is. I guess that's the way it was. So for Matt to call me, that was a real boost, because pretty much, ironically, you know, Matt could have asked anybody in the country, nay the world, to be his team manager, and every single person would have jumped at the chance, you know. But he didn't. He called me. And to me, it's a massive thing, you know. I've always had a big... obviously, not always, but since I raced, a big affinity with Paul. Matt gave me my farewell meeting there, and him and myself and Midlaw and a lot more people down there have kept friends, and it was just really nice for Matt to, Midlaw was coming to a stage of life with them dropping down into the Premier League where he just couldn't do it all, not all the away ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally it was perfect, really, because I said, yeah, I said, look, I don't want to step on anybody's toes. In fact, I rang Neil about a few days later and just spoke to him about it, because I didn't know what stage he was at or anything. And I just said, look, I don't want to stand on anyone's toes. I said, you do whatever you want to do. I said, then I'll do what's left over.
Yeah, oh, that sounds good.
Like, yeah, and he was like, nah, he'll probably end up like me doing most of the away ones, and he'll do most of the home ones. But, you know, I'll get to as many home ones as I can, if I can. And, yeah. It'll be nice, hopefully,
yeah.
next year if it happens to get back involved, you know.
No, I mean, it'd be great to see you around the sport again as well, and I'm sure everybody would look forward to your involvement for sure. Let's go back to the very start of your career, though. I mean, usually I ask how did you get involved in Speedway, but it's not really a relevant question for you because I think we can all guess how you ended up being in and around Speedway, because your dad was a prolific rider first off, and you were probably brought up in the pits, were you?
Not so much in the pits as in the field, really, because my dad didn't actually start Speedway until he was 29.
Really?
He started off by riding trials.
Wow.
And then he went from trials to scrambling, which is now on motocross.
Yeah.
From there, he went to grass track, and then he didn't start Speedway till 29. So, I can never remember his motorbikes and... you know, I think for my dad as well, especially, you know, the fact that he wasn't able to start until such a late age, I guess, his career as in such was in effect over before he started, if you see what I mean. Whereas with me, he I think he'd get the chance to, relive his career that he didn't have, and in a lot of cases when you see that it doesn't work because you see the son doesn't clearly doesn't want to be there, and it's the father who's the driving force behind everything, and you know that never works. I've seen it in junior racing a lot, and not just in motorbikes either. I guess that's in a lot of sports. You know, parents try and really through the kids, but with us it was different because that's exactly what I wanted as well, you know.
Yeah.
So although my dad pushed me hard, that was fine because that's what I wanted as well. So like I say, my earliest memory is of seeing my first motorbike. One of my earliest memories is my dad bought me in this shining orange 25cc Italian little like pit bike thing called an Ito Jet, and that was my first. I actually learned to ride a motorbike before I learned to ride a push bike without stabilizers, if that makes sense.
That's sort of the way to learn, though, isn't it? You know,
it is. It absolutely is. Well, you look at all sports now. You know, I guess you could call it the Tiger Woods phenomenon. You know, he'd been swinging a club since he was 2 years old, and just by the law of averages, by the time you get to 18, 19, 20, you're going to be frigging good.
Yeah.
Whether you're going to be good enough, that's another point altogether, but you're going to be very good anyway. And, I think that's really the way. I don't think you're going to get many top sportsmen who've took up a sport at, say, 14 or something like that, should we say. I think now a lot of it's the ones who were born into certain sports, you know, who are going to rise to the top.
And it is a sport that you were born into. I mean, was there any doubt that you would get to the top, or you would be a professional Speedway rider? Was there any other sort of backup plan, or was Speedway always going to be the thing that you were going to be going into?
Oh God, no. Ever since I can remember, like I say, my earliest memories was that, you know, I was going to be the world speedway champion. That was later on in my career. I went to see sports psychologists and people like that, and a lot of the stuff that they're trying to teach the sportsmen is stuff that I was doing on my own as a kid. You know, like I say about visualization, and all. I used to lay in bed every single night, dreaming about being a speed rider and dreaming about being the world champion. You know.
How did that look in your mind when you were dreaming about it?
It certainly didn't look like it did when I did it. That is, I guess you try and build up as many scenarios in your head as you can. And, if you speak to most sportsmen who've got to the very top, they'll say when it happens, it's, I don't know, for me it was more like a spiritual experience, you know. I wasn't, if you watch me when I go over the line, I wasn't even punching the air. I did like a lap of the track before I did my lap of honour, and I was just like, just like have my head down at the handlebars. Just yeah, it was very strange and very nice.
Obviously, we're going to talk more about that a little bit later on, the 1992 season, and of course becoming world champion. But when did it really begin for you on the track, though, in terms of racing? When did you start competing?
I started racing juniors when I was about 7 or 8. So from 3 till about 7, I was just going with my dad and riding around the interval and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Then from about 7, 8, I went into juniors, but there was no junior spirit right then, so it was junior grass track.
Yes.
Then I won 2 British championships in that, in 1981 and 1982. I think it was 1983, I decided that I didn't want to go up into the last class. There was like 5 classes in the juniors.
Yeah.
Different ages and different bike sizes and that. I didn't want to go into the top class, so I said I just want to get a spirit bike and just go riding in the interval and stuff wherever my dad's racing. So for about the last year, that's what I did. And pretty much when it come to, well, actually, when my birthday is in November, right? 4th of November I'm born. And unfortunately, so coming up to my 16th birthday, 4th of November, that's end of season's finished. So I would have had to wait all the way through till the next season, which was 1985. So what my dad did when he applied for my license from the Speed of Control Board, he put down that my date of birth was the 4th of September, 1968.
Oh, right.
So they gave me a license in September when I was still only 15. And
oh, wow.
In 1984, at the end of the season, if you look at them, I actually won the Suffolk, let me get this right, was it? Suffolk Junior Open Championship at Mildenhall in 1984 when I was 15 and ran illegally.
Shouldn't say that too loud. I don't want them coming taking world titles off of you and stuff.
What are they going to do to me now? I think the house is bolted with that one, like.
But I think there are stories of other riders doing similar, aren't they? I think it's happened before. Definitely.
Oh, God, yeah. And I mean, obviously back then they didn't ask for anything that could, you know, I guess, verify the date of birth.
Yeah.
So I rode on, and when I was applying for like international licenses and stuff like that, I put my date of birth down properly as November. So
yeah.
I don't know when we decided that my birthday had changed, but
probably after your birthday.
Probably.
But when it came to the Middlesbrough Tigers, your dad was the team manager there as well, wasn't he?
He was team manager, yeah. And that didn't actually last that long, because about halfway through the first season, he resigned because of there was a bit of unrest in the team, and there was like niggles, and like people were saying that I was getting favouritism and that. It wasn't that. It was just the fact that he had a reserve. It was flying. And could get double figures, and why would you not give them 6 or 7 rides everywhere you went?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But there was a couple of the older guys in the team who thought it was favouritism. So he said, I have to get rid of your arse, and I'm not doing it anymore. And he just came with me then.
It surely can't be favouritism if you're scoring the points. I mean,
no,
it
clearly wasn't favouritism, but, you know, he cut me that company. He said, that can't be asked with the sniping and the sniding.
Yeah.
He said, I didn't get on with it.
So that was what, 1985 or
it
so?
It was indeed 1985, yes.
And then what happened then after with regards deciding to go to Bradford? Because were there choices to be made, or?
Yeah, there was. Obviously, after we were seriously thinking about going into the top league after 1 year, but you know, I had a couple of offers and stuff, but, you know, we sat down and thought about it, and we thought, you know, just have another year of National League, it was called then.
Mm-hmm.
One more year of National League, you know. And looking back, I'm glad I did. I certainly wouldn't have been ready for the top league then. But at the end of that 1986 season, obviously we had a decision to be made. And one of the main advantages, shall we say, was the fact that at the time, nearly all world championship, big world championship events were held on the continent and stuff, were all on big tracks. And the old Middlesbrough was a little, was a small track. It was what you call a technical track, you know, probably about the size of Oxford.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and bumpy. So it was like, if you seriously want to be world champion, you really need to get good at riding fast on big tracks.
Yeah.
Because believe it or not, there is actually, to ride really fast on a small track, what I call a technical track, you know, Wolverhampton, long straights, tight corners, whatever, is a completely different technique to riding really fast on a big track.
And what would be those differences then to you, in layman's terms?
In layman's terms, the main differences are that on your small, tight technical tracks, the more you've ridden on them, the more laps you got around there, the better you are, because you can work out what you call the angles. So for them small tracks, a lot of the riders can't turn tight enough to get around, so you know they're going to drift out. So you go in wider, turn back, you worked out all the angles. Whereas on a big fast track, it's basically just full gas, and usually he who got the biggest balls and who can ride nearest to the fence goes the fastest. And it's basically like the small technical track. It's all about angles and you don't actually get up to that much of a. I mean, round Wolverhampton, I don't think you'd probably be doing much more than about 55 down the straight, at the end of the straight, even there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you take it all the way up to long track, where the same engines can be doing over 100 mile an hour. The thing that makes you fast on a small track, your ability to turn the bike tight and make those angles, is the exact opposite on a big fast track. So you come in the corner and you turn really hard and you've still got 3/4 of the corner to go. So on the bigger fast tracks, it's all about keeping your wheels in line and trying to keep the bike in a straight line and keep it upright as much as you can. And not even to you know, it looks somewhere like Big Gosh, it's a little bit like Sheffield or Somerset, you know, or Peterborough. Short straights, big sweeping bends.
Yeah.
And on them sort of tracks, you don't really ever want to be locked up. Because if you're locked up, you're scrubbing speed off, you know. You need to let the bike go. Keep your wheels in line and try and build your speed up. And it is two distinct different techniques.
And so Bradford, obviously, very big track, and also a track that had a lot of international events, had the 1985 World Final, of course, and the 1990 World Final.
Well, obviously, at the time, it had only had the 85 one, because we were talking at the end of 86 here. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
We sort of said we should, you know, maybe think about Bradford. It was one of the nearest, well, it was the nearest one in the top league to be home as well.
Yeah.
It was only an hour away. We got the deal done and ended up going and signed for Bradford.
And how was that at that time, though? Because obviously there'd been the move for Halifax to Bradford, so it was relatively, you know, his new team there. And obviously the aftermath of the Kenny Carter tragedy as well, if we call it that. I mean, did you feel sort of any pressure, taking a spot in that team at that level at that time?
No, not really. You know, my whole career, I never, ever, really ever felt any extra pressure from anybody other than, that was any higher than the pressure I used to put on myself, if that makes sense. So it didn't really matter what other people said to me, because in my mind, you know, I was, you know, telling myself and trying to, tell myself that I was going to win anyway, like most guys do. You know, you don't turn up there to get 3 points on a night. You know, you turn up to get a maximum. And you know, back to the Eric thing again.
I was saying that we're going to play some clips from it. On that, one note I did make was this was this documentary you did in 1993.
Yes.
While you're racing at Bradford, and sort of following you and a few of the other riders around.
Paul Bentley gets his cock out.
Yeah, he does. He does.
Yeah,
he does.
Yeah. He thought he'd be one chance for stardom. And that's all people remember him for. That's not all they remember him for, but that is one of the things they remember him for. It takes some good sap, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Yeah, TV, national TV. Yeah, I mean, probably pushed it back beyond 9 o'clock as a result. Yeah. But you know, but at the start of that, you say in this sort of monologue you're doing about why you're in Speedway, and your line was that you don't do it for the money, you do it for the adrenaline, and you do it to win.
Yeah. That was my whole career. You know, there's some riders you can tell. There's some riders I'm not mentioning any names, but some riders I've ridden with over the years. It's all been about the money, you know.
Yeah.
Well, for me, it was about the like I say, the adrenaline of actually racing, and also the you know, the passion of winning things. You know, winning is a greatest drug on the planet. You can't, I tell the young lads all the time, you can't, unless you've done it very much, you can't begin to imagine how amazing it is. And you know, I'm like that with everything, you know, not just Speedway. I was like, if I was playing cards or darts or anything, you know what I mean? I wanted to, desperate to win. And
it's a trait of a champion, though, you know. And
I'd have someone ring up and disagree with me about this, but I think I was good at Speedway probably at the worst time financially in the history of the sport for being good in Speedway, because, you know, 5-10 years earlier, it was still like sort of late 60s into the 70s, you know. We're still on World of Sport and on a Saturday afternoon. And,
yeah.
You know, then when I was really good, there was nothing. No TV, no now, and you know, to just try and go and get sponsors and stuff, it was just so hard, it was ridiculous. And then, obviously, 99, Sky really became involved in filming British Speedway, and you know, obviously the chance then, obviously, you've got much more chance of being able to go out and sell yourself, you know, obviously when you've got TV time. So yeah, I was unlucky on that point, but then again, I guess I'd rather have been world champion at the worst time than not to have been world champion at all.
Well, that you know, that was your time, wasn't it? I mean, you did it regardless of what was thrown at you. I suppose you can always look at it that way. And I mean, what was it like when you first came to Bradford to race? I mean, obviously it was a very big track, a relatively new track in the league, although not a new track in Speedway, because it was around in the 1950s and so on. But
no, that's,
you know, it was back, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad actually, because you know, if I'd have been going up to the top league with like a really famous established club like a Bellevue or something, you know, I might have been a bit more pressure. But the one and only thing that, well, not the one only, but one of the major things I got with riding 10 years at Bradford was that Bradford, unfortunately, it's not a Speedway town. And no matter how much, it just proved in 97, our final year, where we did win the league. The crowds were up a little bit, but you know, 1500 was still the top crowd. Whereas back in the 70s at the old Shea in Halifax, it used to get 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 there.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Halifax was a Speedway town. You know, you get them up and down the country, you know, Pools one, for example, and Halifax was another. And I think a lot of the Halifax fans wouldn't go to watch Bradford just because it was, you know, the next town or the next city over, whatever. And maybe, if you look back, maybe in the 50s and 60s, maybe it's the race of each other. I don't know. I'm not a Speedway historian, but no. And the fact that the stadium was so big and vast as well at Oddsall, so you could have 1,500 people in there, and it would be like the equivalent of 500 somewhere else, because it held 35,000 people.
Oh, yeah, and the rest.
You know, yeah, so
I'm surprised 1,500 was the top crowd at Bradford.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it would have been the top crowd, but
it was an average.
I bet if you average my whole years I was there, I bet we did. I bet there wasn't a year when we averaged many more than 1,500, even the year we won the league in 97.
Yeah, I think that towards the end, apparently, it was because we did one with Neil Machin, and I think he was there on the last day, and he was saying the crowd, I think, on the last day was something like 600.
At Bradford?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But the big thing was that R&M was was bullshitting the whole of Speedway by saying, oh, we're only closing for like a year, two at the most. because they're doing a big refurbishment on the stadium, and then we'll be back. There was never any plans to do a refurbishment of the stadium,
because that was the thing, wasn't it? When towards the end when it was closing, they were going to turn it into a Superdome,
as it was described.
That's
why you would have only had 600 people at the last meeting, because it would have been some make your mouth open meeting.
Yeah.
And it would have been freezing cold, and everyone would have been going, bollocks, don't go to that. But if they'd have thought that it might have been the last ever Spooner meeting there...
Oh, yeah, it would have been a lot more popular.
You could have probably put another knot on that.
Yeah,
you
know? Easy. Yeah, I mean, I think I went to the 85 World Final. I think that was the first time I went there, because I was still fairly young
at
the time.
I was in that programme.
Were you?
Yeah, with a picture of me as like a 16-year-old junior saying, possible future world champion.
No, yeah, wow.
Yeah, definitely.
There's some cine film on, I think it's the Yorkshire Film Archive.
Okay.
And it's not like professionally shot, but it's cine film that somebody shot of the 85 World Final.
Oh,
and it's incredible.
Really?
Because there's stuff that happened that you would never ever remember. And like they had like a guy who was like a stunt rider.
Okay.
Come out on the centre green, and he goes over on a ramp like Evel Knievel over the top of like a Ford Cortina or something like that. It's just like all this razzmatazz.
Okay.
But it's worth looking at.
I don't remember that, like.
Yeah, well, it was very hazy for me. I know that there was a lot more going on, but
I was only sat in the crowd like everybody else, but yeah.
I mean, Bradford started off obviously as a new team, but you know, transported over from Halifax, they had a bit of momentum. But it wasn't very long before Bradford started bossing things and were really kind of starting to command the various tournaments and leagues and cups and so on.
Yeah. Well, if you look in, it would have been from about 90.
Yeah.
95, I would say we won like the knockout cup like three or four times. We were like the Cup Kings. We got to the final like six times or something, won it four times, and then we won the Gold Cup twice. So we sort of we established ourselves, I believe, in the early 90s, you know.
Yeah, and, definitely.
To be fair, we always had a good team. We always had a good team at home, especially, you know. We looked at the riders who'd been through there, like Calvin Tatum, Simon Wigg, Joe Screen, Jimmy Nielsen, Sean Wilson. Wiggy, I think I said Wiggy already, don't I?
Yeah. Paul Thorpe.
Yeah, totally.
Sean Wilson.
We always had a good team, and I think I would like to say that the culmination of that was winning the league in 97 when it was me screening in Laurham with the Healy's. The three British, probably like the three of the best British lads at the time, so it was nice to do it that way, you know.
We were a solid team on the track. I mean, off the track, what was the team spirit like? I mean, because obviously that's a huge part of it as well. The bit that you don't see is, you know, how the team get on in the pits and in the changing rooms and so on.
You don't win that with a shit team spirit.
Yeah.
And literally, they all say one egg can spoil the basket, and it literally can. You could have six really good lads in the team who all get along on that, and you only need one rotten apple and he'll spoil it for everybody. If you're going to win stuff, you need to have a good team spirit.
And so what are your sort of favourite memories of like particularly riding for Bradford then at that time? I mean, what's the sort of standout you know, matches or races that sort of come to mind, you know, of that place?
God knows.
You must have loads.
Obviously,
like,
riding there 10 years, there was a lot. Do you know, I never, ever won an open meeting there of any type.
Did you not?
No. Even when I won the World Final that year, the World Semi-Final, I had run off a pair and he fucking passed me. On my own track. I was fucking devastated.
Well, there's always that pride, though, isn't there, I suppose, that, you know, when it's your own track, I suppose, you don't want to get beaten.
Yeah. I mean, over the years, with the type of riders we've had there, obviously, you're talking about your long track specialists like Wiggy and Tatum, and then you've got, you know, people like Sean Wilson who went on to be the king of Sheffield, you know, big fast track. And we always wanted a load of grip on there, you know, we always wanted as grippy as we could get it. And for a few years, it was quite wavy down the straights, like, and it really freaked a lot of the away riders out. They'd come there and they'd see it, and the banking was really steep. Did you ever actually go down on the track?
No, but I know it was banked, a lot of banking. I went down to the fence at the top,
yeah, yeah.
So you see how far down it is.
Well, the turns one and two were had quite a bit of banking, but they were like normal banking. So they have, you know, where it cambers off, we call it cambering off, and like most tracks have a bit of banking in. When they get to about the last meter, 2 meters from the fence, the banking levels off.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really ride on it. And turn one and two was like that, but turn three and four was banked all the way to the bottom of the fence. So literally, you could ride 6 inches from the fence. And if you went, I'll tell you how banked turns three and four were at Bradford, right? If you went, if you walked out on the track in the middle of turn three and four,
yeah,
and went stood on the curb, on the inside curb,
yeah,
the bottom of the fence was about 3 foot above your head.
That's quite a way up.
Yeah. That was how steep the banking was at Bradford. And like I say, we always wanted it really grippy. And it did freak a lot of VUA riders out, you know, and they were beaten before they came. We used to like make jokes and stuff like that. So it was all good, you know.
Yeah, I know it's been mentioned. I think somebody else mentioned before, like going to Bradford and being sort of defeated before you'd started, just because of the imposing nature of the size of the track and all the rest
of it. Yes, totally, yeah. And then they go for the track walk and they're digging their foot in and it's deep as hell, you know, and like, oh, God. And it was great because they were beat before I started. You know, most teams, when it was like that, the away teams come... if they had two riders who could ride it, they were doing well. Usually the away teams had one guy who'd have a go, like the number one, and the others were just, you know, scraping for seconds and thirds. But, it was great, great times. You know, it was a tear in my eye when that place closed down, because obviously I knew what other people didn't know, you know. And, it was a big part of my life.
Talk, though, of it coming back, though, next year, I think... You not reckon?
It's the rugby league version of the BSPA that owns the stadium, and because the Bradford Council gave it to the Bulls for £1 after we left, and then the Bulls then went fucking bust.
Yes.
And the rugby league BSPA people bought the stadium, and I think they are keen to have it, obviously. If you own a stadium, you'd want it, you know, every night, wouldn't you, if you could? But like I say, as far as Speedway is concerned, without a lot of money, I can't see it. Or without a really shitty track. And like, you know, bringing somewhere back with a really shitty track. I don't know. If I had to bet, I'd bet that it doesn't happen.
Well, that's the thing, I suppose, isn't it? We want it. We want the same memories as we had, I suppose, and you wouldn't want it to be a half measure. We'll find out in fullness of time, and fingers crossed for it, of course. This is Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan. Welcome along. My guest in this episode, Bradford Duke legend, world champion in 1992, Gary Havelock. And we're going to be talking about his time at some other clubs like Poole and management with Coventry. And he's also going to choose his all-time 1-7 and build his perfect dream Speedway meeting in just a bit as well, so stick around for that. Right now, though, I want to turn our attention to that season, 1992. Obviously, it was a big one. You became world champion, and I know that you've said in other interviews that you feel that in 1992, regardless of how the world championship was decided, and it was a one-off world final for you, but even if it was a GP or however they decided it, it would probably have come down to between one of two riders, you or Per Jonsson in that year. You felt that between you were just a level above everybody else.
Either me or Per, yeah. And I really don't think I'm being saying crazy things by saying that, you know. I top scored in every round I went in. So I either won it or I had a runoff to win it. I think Per did very similar along his route. And then obviously we came first and second. The World Pairs final, Lonigal, I think I got paired 17 and then Per got about 16. All through the year we were head and shoulders above the rest, I believe.
And what was the difference in that year? I mean, you got off to a great start, but I mean, was there anything that you changed about your sort of setup that year, or were you just sort of fired up for it and just on a winning streak and keeping it going?
I think where it changed massively was obviously going to Bradford and riding with Neil Evatt, who was the captain, and he was also did his own engines. So getting to know Neil quite a bit, and then one time he said, "Give me one of your engines, Avi. I'll make it go faster." I said, "Give the engine to him," and he made it go a lot faster than it had been going. So I was like, "Okay, oh, yeah, that's cool." And then we got to the point towards the end of halfway through the 91 season, went and got some engines from Germany. Because although Neil Evatt was, engine tuner, he wasn't really an engine tuner. As such, he was an engine servicer. And, you still had to buy your engines off somebody. And Neil had been dealing with this old German tuner called Otto Lantenhammer, Lanty. We said, "Oh, I'll get a couple of engines off him." So I went and got some engines from him. So towards the latter end of 91... the start of 92, obviously I'd been on these engines for a few months, and everything just clicked into place. You know, I certainly felt during sort of 1990 season all through 91 that I was improving, that I was winning bigger and bigger things. I think the last step was probably getting the engines, buying the engines from Lanty in Germany, you know. And having really, really fast engines, fast tuned engines, knowing that nobody else was going on faster engines than me, you know, because I was always very confident of my own ability, but sometimes that's not enough. Certainly, more and more in this day and age, I believe that it's down to the engine. Back in my day, you know, I think a lot of it was still down to the skill of the rider. You could see the eras coming of the fast engines, you know, the supersonic engines, and the people paid silly money to buy them. And, yeah. But yeah, I don't know.
And you were doing it on an upright as well in that time.
Yeah, well,
pre lay down.
Yeah. So what year was it? 96. Was that the year when we were all in
about,
one big league?
Yeah, it was about then, wasn't it? Yeah.
So we were all in one big. No, 95, maybe 95. 95 was when they brought the lay downs in the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
So we were like, but you couldn't ride them in Britain.
Yeah.
So we were like riding all our matches on uprights, and then on a weekend trying to go out to Germany or Sweden or somewhere, try and ride this fucking lay down thing in the Grand Prix. And like, we had no chance, absolute no chance. And it wasn't until we got introduced into Britain that the lads even started catching up a little bit, you know. But good old BSB, never worry about young British lads on the world scene, eh? When he was going to come through the gates, more important.
I think Mark Loren was the first person I saw on a laydown at Bradford. I think he was the first one to get one out. And he might have ridden it even after the meeting. Maybe it was that year you're talking
maybe
about.
Maybe he was practicing or something.
Yeah. Maybe he was practicing on the bigger tracks.
Yeah, to go to a track, and like if you could get a bit of practice afterwards, so you'd be taking 3 and 4 bikes. So like the two that you rode in the fucking meeting, and then the two laydowns.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, get some setups in that goal, and within like 10 minutes after a meeting somewhere, it was impossible.
And as you said, you went through that 92 season. You were the British champion, which was you retained the British championship.
I think I might have won the semi as well.
Overseas champion.
Commonwealth first, Kingsland.
Oh, Commonwealth, yeah.
Yeah, I had a big crash at Big Gosh the weekend before. I was riding the Polish League and broke my hand. Metacarpals, the ones that run from your knuckles to your wrist.
Yes.
I broke one of them in my left hand and ripped all my shoulder open. And I still managed to join top score there. And then went out for a runoff, and I was like, and it started raining. And I was like, just let them go, you know what I mean? So I had third in that one. Then I won the overseas.
Yeah.
That was when the Yanks come in at Coventry.
Yes, I think I went to that, I think.
Yeah. Then was it one more after the overseas? I think went to the World Semi.
Was it Intercontinental? Was that still a thing?
No, that was years. That was
before.
Was always the last one before the World.
Yeah,
Final.
Yeah.
But they changed it to two semis. I don't know what year they changed it, but there was certainly two semis. One was at Bradford, and one was God knows where, fucking Austria or somewhere, right? Like that. You know what I mean? One of these fine spirited backwaters,
somewhere in a forest in Sweden.
Yeah. So let's say I was thankful I got drawn in Bradford.
Yeah, that definitely will have helped. And then, of course, the big one, 1992 World Final, and that was at Wroclaw, wasn't it? And
it
obviously,
did
that help you, the location? Because it's I would say it's not the same as Bradford, but it's a decent-sized track, isn't it?
I wouldn't say it really helped me or hindered me in a way. You know, obviously, with riding at Bradford on a big track, it was good and that was the whole idea of one of the reasons we went to Bradford in the first place, you know. So if that was if that helped, then yeah, great. But I saw many interviews and that people saying, "Oh, first world final, you know, it'll be great, you know, the experience and all that," as you said, didn't it? Your first world final, you go there for experience. And I was like, "Fuck that!" Excuse me, like, "Fuck that! I ain't going for experience. I'm going to win." I'd beaten every single one of them riders over several times in the league. So in my mind, there was absolutely no reason whatsoever why I couldn't beat them again.
And there was no guarantee that you'd ever get to another world final. You don't know, that time?
Absolutely not, no. Like I say, I always dreamed of being world champion. I never dreamed of being the best speed rider ever. Don't know why. All I ever dreamed of was just of being the world champion. I think that probably hindered me for a few years after I won it, maybe, you know, psychologically. Sort of thinking, oh, what am I going to do now, like, you know?
You'd achieved the aim.
Yeah. This dream that had been, you know, the last 20 years of my life had been achieved at such a young age. But there you go.
And how was it then? I mean, because through the course of that evening, obviously this was back in the days when it was a one-off world final. Everybody starts on zero and stuff, and you know it could be won and lost in one heat or not.
Well, you know, depending on what happens, was because my first race I was against Per Jonsson and I won it and he came last.
Well, that certainly makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Makes
Simple
all
as
the
that.
Difference. And like you look back to the fact that gate four was a massive advantage in them early heats there, and I'd been drawn at number eight, which is heat two, gate four. Thank you very much. You know, another day, another track. It could have been fucking graveyard, and I could have got filled in full of mud like Per did, and end up running the last. But it is what it is. And then it started raining, and then it come down thunder and lightning for about fucking half an hour, didn't it? And the track was flooded from, literally from the curb to about three quarters of the way out of the track was flooded. And I remember Mitch Shearer, a couple of the other riders were running around the pit saying, like, why don't we just get it cancelled? We'll just get it cancelled. We'll all come back tomorrow and start again. And I was like, fuck that.
Damn
I've
right.
already done the hardest bit. It's beating Per, my first ride, as far as I was concerned. Like, my leg was hurting because a bike ran into me. And but I was like, nah, let's go. Let's do it. We're racing.
Yeah, race on. And then that heat where it was all confirmed, I mean, you know, what were the emotions?
Heat
17. Heat 17.
Yeah.
And like you were up against Mitch Shearer in that heat, weren't you, I think?
I don't know. I think I was, yeah.
Yeah.
I only need the first or second to be certain. I remember, just before going out for the race, I remember nearly being physically sick in my helmet. There was just so much emotions going on with my mechanic. As you see my mechanic's hands shaking like a dog shit and razor blades, and my dad shouting something in one ear and Neil Everett shouting something in the other ear, and I'm thinking, I started spinning, I'm like, fuck, you know. And I was thinking, I wish you'd just open that gate. Finally the gate opened and I like pushed off and then sort of gave myself a proverbial slap around the chops and said, sort yourself out. And I actually think that was the best start I've ever made. In my last ride in the world final, it was off gate two. It wasn't one of the favourable gates. But when they filmed it from the front, and normally from the front, you can't see when somebody's made a good start. You have to be sort of from the side. But you could even see it from the front. In fact, in this day and age, it was one of them that had probably pulled it back.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Well, at least they didn't. And no. You made it a great start. You were definitely first to the first bend. And then you were kind of like long tracking it, weren't you? Sort of down the back straights.
It was really
yeah.
funny, actually, because somebody put something on Facebook the other day. And because of all this talk about the way Smarzik rides his bike and that. And yeah. Like, oh, yeah, the way he hangs off the back. His arse is over the back wheel. He's trying to get as much traction as possible. And I was thinking, I used to do that. Nobody says that. And then, was it? So it might have even been Peter Walks or somebody like that put something on Facebook, apparently, over the weekend about he wasn't the first, having he was the first sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
A picture of me at Vatslav, long tracking it.
Yeah, you're sort of tucked in as fast as you can go.
Yeah, well, this is like, I've got to ride my bike the fastest I've ever ridden it, ever.
Yeah. So,
every last ounce of straight line speed, whatever, I was going to try and nick it.
And you said about crossing the finish line and sort of not having sort of a massive amount of motion. You weren't punching the air and stuff like that.
I didn't know whether I'd have done a wheelie over the line and punched the air. I didn't do anything. I just rode over the line and then just put my head down on my handlebars and just like trundled round in a complete whirlwind of emotions and feelings, and just insane, really insane.
And then you get to lift the trophy and all that, and when at what point does it really sink in? Because I imagine it's all like one of these occasions that sort of whizzes by, and it's only like the days afterwards where you think, "Whoa, bloody hell, what have I done?"
Well, I remember I got picked for the drug test as usual, and I remember it was that hot that I must have just sweated like every last bit of liquid out of my body, right? So straight afterwards, they told me about the drug test. So like, I'm drinking water, I'm drinking beer, I'm just trying to get liquid forced into me. Took me about over an hour to do it, didn't it? And then they were like, "You got to come to the press conference."
Mm-hmm.
They've been waiting for you. So I've got took over like the press conference. So I've got my levers tied around my waist in a knot. Right, I've got a fag in one hand and a can of lager in the other hand. I walk into the press conference. There's about 150 people in this big room waiting for me. it was bizarre. Was understatement.
I remember that you had like a homecoming thing, didn't you, at Bradford? When you paraded the trophy round sort of stuff as well. That must have been a great moment.
Oh, God, yeah. Because, I mean, a lot of my fans who had been with me for 10 years at Bradford didn't actually get to go because it was difficult. It was such a long way back then, and only just come out of communism and stuff. And to bring the trophy home and to parade it around Bradford was special.
Yeah, that was a great day, that. It was like an extra special meeting.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, the meeting was sort of inconsequential. I think people were there just to see you with the trophy.
Yeah, I don't even remember who it was. I remember it was a big trike thing I had to sit on the back of.
Yeah, massive, yeah. Brilliant achievement. And how did that then change you sort of going forward? I mean, you said it sort of affected you, but did that sort of raise you up in the sport in general, you know, sort of around Europe and what have you?
I don't really think it raised my profile within the sport at all. I'd like to think that I raised the profile of Speedway by all the, you know, all the invitations and stuff I was taking to be in magazines and on TV shows and stuff like this, you know. So although I got absolutely no help whatsoever off British Speedway, I'd like to think that personally did some good for British Speedway.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. It was a massive moment. And first time we'd had a British world champion for so long as well, you know.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Which, you know, anybody who's followed my career knows how patriotic I am. And, you know, for me to pull on a Union Jack race jacket, you know, whether it's representing your country or whether it's representing, you know, individually in a big meeting, you're still representing your country, you know. And to me, that was about as good as it got in the sport, you know. When I first rode for England, it was amazing. But you know, when I first time rode for England, when I was captain England, well, to me, that's, he doesn't get any better in sport. You know, if you're a sports person in any sport anywhere in the world, to captain your national side is about as good as it gets for me. And, you know, I'll always treasure that.
Was that with our great friend Eric Bucock?
Yeah, some of it was indeed, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, him and when I first got brought into the England setup, it was him and Pratty.
Yes.
Who were the team managers, and we had some laughs. Oh, we had some laughs all around the world. remember one time we were going to I don't even know where we were going. We were going to ride abroad somewhere, and it was in Italy, and me and Bowie flew from up north. And yeah. Pratty flew from down south, and he was landing like half hour after us. So we like landed, get like organised a hire car and stuff. And then I don't know, I think it was my idea. I just got this big piece of cardboard, right? And went in the shop and brought a black marker pen. And just wrote Pratt in massive letters, and I stood there waiting for Colin to come out. and then. The last official England touring team to go to Australia was us in the winter of 87-88, that winter. We actually went as the official England Lions. We had 7 test matches, and we did some individual meetings and stuff as well. And Eric was the team manager on that, obviously with his connection with his brother Nigel, obviously being and living over there. So, yeah, we had some fun on that trip as well. Roscoe turned the car over with the trailer on the back. I'll drive. I'm a lorry driver. I drive for hours, mate. An hour and a half up the road, he turned the car over.
Well, it's a wonder you're here to tell the tale.
But I wasn't in it. Sean Wilson was.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, we were in the other car. Sean Wilson was in that one. He tells the story much better than me.
And Bowie, of course, was involved in Bradford as well. He was team manager at Bradford for, you know, a good
yeah,
amount of time.
He was, actually, for a while, yeah. Yeah, yeah, actually. Now you've come to mention it.
Because that documentary I was telling you about, I mean, this when we're talking about, I think plenty of people have mentioned about, you know, the pressures on Speedway riders, and the biggest pressure is sort of, you know, earning your money and all this kind of stuff. And this is the quote that I recall.
Go on.
At the end of the day, you've got a living to earn. If you don't score, you don't earn. And if you don't earn, I suppose you don't eat. And if you don't eat, you die. Yeah.
Speedway summed up in 6 seconds.
Priceless. Absolutely priceless. see, that wasn't me. I never, ever, ever, ever went to the start line once thinking about money in my life. I don't think. Ever.
Yeah, but in that documentary, though, you did finish second in your first race, and this was his pep talk to you.
Right. Just about to start there. Yeah. You got stuffed out wide, covered in shit, couldn't see. I know you can't pass your partner, because he's riding up inside, outside, every corner. It's single. And when they all came out, he just locked. 3 bikes stopped you dead, yeah. Can't do a thing, man.
Yeah, that's what he would ride. Yeah. Plenty of time, isn't there? Plenty of time. See them, these riders in this day and age don't know the barn, right? That was Bradford back in the day, right? When the smallest piece of shale was about 10 mil.
Yes.
And there was no dirt reflectors.
No, no.
That's where men were men, I tell you.
Yeah, I think I saw Hans Nielsen with a dirt deflector, I think, at Bradford. Right. That's the first time I saw one. He was testing them out.
Right, yeah.
Sound about right.
Yeah.
But yeah, the shale used to come flying over because the guys who raked the track at Bradford used to pick the tear-offs or the visors or whatever that had been discarded off, and they'd like hand them to the kids at the front.
Oh, really?
Sort
brilliant.
Of save your eyesight, kids. You know, is a ripped-off tear-off. It's,
there you go.
You know.
If you're on the straights, it's not so bad, but if you're on the corner, you can get sprayed.
Oh, yeah.
Go to my local track, my red car, right, and there's just outside the bar on the back of the air fence, so facing the fans, there's a white sign about 12 inches square, and it says, "Caution, flying shale."
No.
Yeah, no fucking shit.
I think I've seen that, actually. I've been down a red car, I've seen
the
that.
The most ridiculous waste of ink ever in your life.
The quirks of Speedway. Now,
absolutely.
With Bradford closing, obviously you had to find other teams. I mean, you rode for some teams on the continent as well, didn't you? You were sort of big in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, I was always right as much as I could, right since about 1991, I think.
Yeah.
I started riding abroad in Sweden and Poland and stuff. I've rode for four or five teams in Poland and probably three or four in Sweden. But probably the most successful would be the period of from 1999 to about 2004 in Sweden with Massana.
Yes, yeah.
And there was myself and Tony Rickardson, Lee Adams. There was a guy called Tony Casper, a Czech guy who died of a brain tumour since. A young Antonio Lindbach when he burst onto the scene at 16. And we had this core of the same team for about 5 years, and we did so well. I think we won something like a gold, two silvers and three bronze or something like that in a 5 year period. And when we won the gold in 2000, our home leg was the second leg because they ran like Tuesday, Wednesday. We were away, it was at Rustigana, the home leg.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had about 7,000 people there, right? And then the next night in Harvester, 12,500 people.
Wow, that's a big crowd. Yeah,
biggest crowd I've ever had. And we won the gold, and then we went on a kind of like open top bus around the whole of the town. I think every single person that wasn't at the stadium was out their house cheering and clapping on the streets. It was like being a rock star.
Yeah, I was going to say, bonkers. Rock star stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it was bonkers, but like really good fun and some good friendships formed. You know, I'm still really good friend with Tony Cardson. So, yeah, it's all good.
And for British teams, you spent a good deal of time racing. Well, you raced at Eastbourne, Peterborough.
Well, I did, yeah, after Pool shot, I went to Eastbourne. That didn't really work out. They sacked me. And then I went to Pool in about August of that year, of 98. And then that was when Matt was the team sponsor at Pool. He had a company called Hair Arena, hairdressing salons. So they were, when I went to Pool in 1998, they were the Pool Hair Arena Pirates. And it was in that winter when Matt Ford and Mike Golin bought the club from... I forget the guy's name, I've had it before. But because I remember I got friendly with Matt because he was the team sponsor. So all through the winter, we were talking on the phone and he was saying, oh, I said, mate, there's a chance to get me up by the speeder. What do you think? I went, mate, don't even think about it. Anybody who puts their own hard-earned money in a speedway club at this current time is bonkers. And thankfully, he ignored everything I said. And I guess otherwise the Pool legacy that's happened since him and Midlaw came in might not have happened.
Yeah, it worked out for the best in the end, though, didn't it?
So, it certainly did, yes. All good there. It certainly did. But, you know, there's a lot of promoters could take a leaf out of Matt's book, you know. Matt makes it his number one concern, you know. To me, it just seems like a lot of speed riders have successful businesses, other businesses, and they run speedway. God forbid, a tax loss or whatever you want to call it. Speedway isn't their number one, you know. It's just so, if it goes good, it's all right. But, you know, with Matt, he works hard and he makes it happen and gets the right people around him to make things happen. And, you know, that's why they've been so successful. And also he's loyal, you know. Midlaw, look how long Midlaw's, when Matt took over in 1999, he installed Midlaw as a team manager and he's been there ever since, you know.
Yeah, it's been a great partnership, hasn't it, between them all?
Yeah, it has.
And hopefully you can get involved in that next season, fingers crossed.
Yes, well, you know, Matt asked me, you know, are you still interested to do the same? And I was like, yeah, 100%. So, we might be able to put another string in my bow as another manager.
Yeah, and you've done some managing, haven't you, with Coventry and...
And Berwick. And obviously with Neil being the England team manager as well. And, mm-hmm. You know, with me riding for Paul, we've been from up, all the way up north, you know. I used to stop over at Neil's quite a lot. So we got really friendly with Neil, and Neil's a star, man, he really is. And, you know, he did a fabulous job as England team manager, and he does a great job as the pool team manager, you know. But Matt's the guy who picks the teams. Midler has no input whatsoever in the team building. Midler just turns up on press day and goes, right, these are the guys I'm working with, let's get it on. Which is amazing when you think about it.
It is, really. This is Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan. My guest in this episode, a Great Britain Speedway legend, legend of the Bradford Dukes, the Pool Pirates, many others as well, and not least Redcar, of course, too. Gary Havelock is my guest, and he's going to be choosing his all-time dream meeting still to come before the end of this. We need to pay a bit of attention, though, to the end of your racing career, though, Gary, because it happened in a way that you wouldn't have expected or indeed would have liked with an accident where you were hit by a bike, and that caused an injury that left you without use of your left hand. And talk us through that and what you had to go through, because that yeah. was obviously not the way that you would have liked your career to have ended on the track.
No, certainly not. No, it was bad. It was bad. It was really bad. There's nothing good I can say about it. Without going into too much gory detail, the whole thing was really bad. We crashed, and I spent a couple of days in my local hospital. Then they transferred me down to Leeds, and then I had like a couple of operations. And basically, my left hand doesn't work. I went back in 2015 because my surgeon said there was this other thing they could do and get me elbow working, and blah de blah de blah. We want to take some muscle out my thigh and put it in there, and then some nerves out my ribs, from in between my ribs, and do this Frankenstein shit. So I was like, all right, then. Like, got to 2015, and like, I wasn't getting any improvement. I was like, right, let's try it. So I done that, and then that was supposed to have been one operation, 4 days in hospital, and that turned into four operations, a month in hospital, and nearly dying of sepsis.
God.
Yeah.
It's not what you want.
And all for nothing, because what they put in had gone all bad and they had to take it back out anyway. So I'm at the position I'm at now. I'm still in constant pain. My pain is just depends on what level it is, you know. Just on a random, to try and explain to people, if you were to put your pain on a 0 to 10 basis, 0 being no pain at all and 10 being the worst pain ever. Right up until about 6 or 7, I can normally all right. I can function. I can do stuff. I can get on with it. If it gets above there, then I can't do stuff anymore. I just have to like try and concentrate on taking a lot of painkillers and you know, getting right. But it is what it is. Unfortunately, it happened and it's happened. And would I change it? If I had to change everything, I don't know. It's a very good question.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, unfortunately, it's the cards you dealt.
But
it
is, you know, it is. I mean, we all know the risk, you know, when we sling our legs over these 500cc single cylinder methanol burning death machines that slide around the corners for other people's entertainment. We all know the risks, and, you know, although it would have been really nice to get out in one piece, at least I've got out. And I'm still walking and talking, and I see my kids every day, and I can still drive and do this and that and the other. And, you know, I really feel for. And the other thing, I think, at least I managed to have my career before I got injured.
Yeah.
I always think of Dazzy Ward, God bless him, you know, I had so much to come, you know. He was going to be multiple times world champion. And now he's in a wheelchair. That's the sad side of Speary, unfortunately, but I guess you can't get one without the other.
Yeah, it's sad when it happens. It's definitely sad when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, my accident, you probably watched, a lot of people probably watched the GP, not the GP, I wasn't the GP, it was Polish League. It was Polish League just after the GP, and you know, with the Woofy crash?
Yes. Oh, yeah. The Niels Christian Eriksen. Yes, yes, I did. Yeah,
well, that was pretty much identical to my crash. Come in the corner, somebody right on my chuffer, back wheel just let go. I did a 180, fell off, and the guy behind me rode straight over the top of me.
Yeah, nothing they can do.
Yeah, and he was saying he's a bit battered and bruised and that, but he gets up, walks away. Oh, I don't. You know, and that's just millimetres, I guess. If it was, I always say if it was a couple of inches one way, I might have just got away with a broken collarbone. If it was a couple of inches the other way, I might have broken my fucking neck.
Yeah.
And being a quadriplegic, quadriplegic.
Yeah.
God bless.
Same for Niels as well, I suppose. You know, he's badly bruised and all that, and he's got up,
and his arms and legs would still work.
Yeah, but maybe if he had the same crash again on another day, it might not have gone that way.
That's what I'm saying, it's one of the things. It's almost identical type crash. I don't know, two different tracks and all that, but yeah, he gets up hard on.
Yeah.
They always used to say, when I first started, they always used to say the worst crashes always seem to be the... Apparently when Alan Wilkinson got paralysed, apparently that was an out of a crash.
Yeah, the simplest ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
I've seen one or two, and like you say, the spectacular crashes are never usually that.
Yeah,
I'm always worried when someone slides off quietly and then doesn't get up after it. Yeah,
that was the other thing. You get these riders. I know they do it now, obviously, so their bike can get back to the pits and get fixed and all that. But me and Sean Wilson, we always had our friends or family of some form with us.
Yeah.
So, to us, if we crashed, first thing you do is you crash, like, move my head, move my arms, move my legs. Oh, yeah, I can move everything.
Yeah.
You get up.
Yeah.
So, that whoever it is, your family, even if your dad in the pits or your mum in the stands or your girlfriend or whoever, sees he's all right.
Yeah.
Well, you get some other riders who are they've grazed a little toenail and they stay on the track for, like, 10 friggin' minutes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a big ordeal, but hey-ho.
Hey-ho.
Which is life.
This is Humans of Speedway. That is Gary Havelock. I'm Ian Brannan, and we move to the section now, Gary, of Humans of Speedway that we do in every episode. And if you're listening to this one for the first time, then check out all the other previous episodes, because I've asked the same questions to all the people that we've had on in the previous about this, about designing your dream Speedway meeting. If you could have the dream lineup, dream team riding for you, the dream opposition in the perfect stadium with the perfect referee with the perfect track, how would it look? And those are the questions we're about to ask, and we're going to start by asking Gary, which track would you have your dream meeting on, not taking into account any of the facilities, just purely the shale? Where are we racing on?
Bradford.
Well, you've ridden it enough times.
Yeah.
Just because of the what's the attraction of it? Just because you ride fast
because it was a big track. It was also a wide track. Speed riders like wide tracks, you know, tracks that are really wide. If you get into trouble, you've got a bit of chance to get out of it, you know. It was a wide track. It was a fast track. It was banked. In my eyes, all speed tracks should be banked at least a little bit, you know. You know, it was the best pits. It had the best changing rooms. It was.
You just had to watch out for Paul Bentley walking around in them.
That's it.
Yeah. The stadium then that you'd put that track in. I mean, would it stay in Bradford, or would you have that stadium with other surroundings?
Be nice to think you could put it in Wroclaw.
Yeah. If you could, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, let's do that.
What was the atmosphere like that night with you know, from the crowd, from that point of view?
Oh, it was phenomenal. Yeah, it was phenomenal. I mean, although the majority of them were Polish, there was quite a large contingency of English guys. You certainly knew where they were. They had flags and everything. But I'm not sure how many was there. I think it was 45,000 or something like that.
Wow, it's a decent crowd.
Very good crowd. And I mean, when you look back to the days of PC and Ivan and that, I think they rode like in Poland when it was 100,000 people.
Yeah,
in some tracks, you know,
it's just massive,
mind blowing. Yeah,
it's time to move on to the Javi all time dream team. Then the 1-7, any rider alive or not, no points limits. It's just a free for all. Your all time 1-7. Who's going to be number one?
Per Jonsson.
Yeah. Well, you and he had a lot of great battles.
We did, and we never even really knew each other before Per got injured, and about after he got injured, and it seeped out how bad he was, and that I was like, oh shit, and I actually wrote him a letter. It was obviously back in the day, there was no phones or internet or texts or anything like that, but I got his address off somebody and wrote him a letter, and apparently he really cherished it, like, you know.
Oh, that's really nice.
And just said that, I know we were never friends, but we'd never met, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And anyway, whatever, but what an amazing rider.
Yeah.
That guy probably kept his wheels in line better than anybody I can ever remember.
He was fast, wasn't he? And very fast rider.
You know what I said earlier in the three? Wheels in line equals speed.
And I don't know if you saw, but they were marking the world final, the 1990 world final in Bradford.
Right.
The sort of anniversary of it. The other, I think it was a month or two ago, and they
it would have been normally the end of August.
Yeah, they and they named a bus Per Jonsson.
Oh, wicked! Oh, awesome. Did anybody ever take a picture of it and let him know?
I think someone did, yeah.
Oh,
good, and there's another one called Eric Gunderson as well for the
fantastic
85 world final.
Yeah.
Look out for those. Okay, who else we got then?
I don't think anyone at seven in the world could ever be right without having this guy in it, Tony Richardson.
What a rider.
Again, a guy that I rode against for several years before actually really knowing him.
Yeah.
It was only when it was actually by accident, me and Lee Richardson that year, 99, we signed for Lynn Sherbin, a team in the Premier League. And that year, each track in that league had an adult track in the Elite League.
Okay.
If you like. So, and it just so happened that Lynn Sherbin's parent track was Bassana. So they got in touch with me and said, oh, would you fancy coming and ride for us? And blah, blah, blah. I didn't really know what's about, to be honest. I didn't really know who rode for them or anything. So I like, went up there and rode for them. And like you say, yeah, I stayed about 5 years. Got to know the guys really well and, you know, got some lifelong friends out of it.
Brilliant. Okay, so Tony Richardson's on there. We're doing well with the Swedes so far.
We are, aren't we? Yeah.
Who's next?
Right, who's next is Lee Richardson.
Of course, yeah. And, we know what happened with Lee at the end, of course, from something that we've sort of
really
previously...
bittersweet because it happened at Wroclaw.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. But, I first got to know Lee when he came to Bradford in 99. And he was a real raw then, you know. He'd been riding for Reading and John Davis had got him together and this, that and the other. And it was actually one of these meetings we were riding on a Thursday night in Linköping in the Swedish Premier League. And Lee had asked me if he'd qualified for the World Under 21 final at Voyant. And he'd asked me if I had anything on. And I was like, no, I haven't got any meetings or anything. And they said, like, there's any chance you'd like come with me? So I was like, well, let me make some calls and that. And I was like, yeah. So we got a lift from Sweden to Denmark, and his mechanics turned up with the van and all that. And he won the World Under 21 Championship. And I didn't even know this till years later when I was talking with Mrs. And I remember now when we first got there, we said, oh, well, let's go have a look at the track. As we were walking, I was looking at the track. I just picked up this there was all like pebbles and stuff around where the standing area and stuff. And I see this like round pebbly thing, so I thought I'd pick it up. And we got out of the track and I made up some bullshit about it being the lucky stone.
Yeah.
And I gave it to Lee and I obviously won the World Under 21 Championship. So he kept this fucking lucky stone, for the rest of his life, and his kids have got it now, apparently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was like really touched me when I heard the story. It was like, oh, man. And that's some really good times with Lee. And again, Speedway, as amazingly rewarding as it can be, it could also be devastatingly cruel.
Yeah.
Devastatingly cruel.
It was a huge shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah,
terrible. Terrible incident, and very hard for everybody.
Yes.
Okay, so Lee Richardson is in your all-time 1-7.
The next one, unfortunately, is going to have to be foreign again.
Okay.
Well, it's going to have to be Greg Hancock.
Well, you can't go wrong. I mean, Greg rode in your farewell meeting, didn't he?
He did, and you know what, right? When he agreed to do that farewell meeting, right, when I was organising, getting a bike to ride and all that, and he went, Avi, do us a favour, don't give me number out to anybody. But I went, mate, I don't give anybody's number out to anybody. But he said, every man and his dog's trying to get me to do the testimonial and this open meeting or whatever. And he says, fuck that. He says, I want to fly in, do your meeting, and fly back out. He said, but whatever happens, mate, I'll be there. And that was amazing. Like, some of the things, like, when it pissed down, I think it was about heat 6, it absolutely hiked down for about 10 minutes. Mm. Like, that stopped the race and it rained that heavy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was in the bath, I, like, raced down the pits and that. And we got all the riders together and everything. And I was like, look, lads, it's up to you. The rain has stopped by now. I said, obviously, it's to be fucking farewell, mate, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I will completely understand if you don't want to ride, you know. I've ended up fucking injured for the rest of my life. I said, don't want to see any of you. Every single one of them lads went, ah, nah, fuck it, we'll race. We're right.
Oh, wow. That's dedication.
It was amazing, yeah. It really was amazing. So, and a man who's won the World Championship 4 times and at the age of, was it 46? Greg Hancock's done things that I don't think any sportsman in any sport will ever do again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, 46 and he was, yeah, was racing beyond that, wasn't he? Even.
Yeah, so. Oh, God, he raced beyond that, yeah. Yeah. It's actually, you know, all right, people will... You'll always get one freak who participates till late in any sport. But... not to be the fucking world champion.
Yeah, I know. He was just getting better and better,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah, amazing.
Okay, so Greg is in.
Yeah, and then obviously if Greg's in, this next guy has to be in. It was Maciej Janowski.
Yes. Yeah, he's sort of a little protege, isn't he?
Greg's protege. There's a reason why he's in there, and it's not because of his speedway. Unfortunately, I can't tell you this reason, because he promised me not to tell anybody.
Right, okay.
So he's in there because he is one of the most amazing fucking human beings
that cool.
I've ever met, basically.
All right, so that's 5 in your all-time team. 2 more spaces left. Where are we going next, then, for the final 2?
Okay, I'll fill the rest up with some Brits.
Go on, right? Then.
It's going to be hard this though, because I've got like 4 Brits for 2 places.
You have to have a race off.
Right. I'm going to put my mate in. Andrew Silver.
Yeah.
Again, a guy who, before we met, we actually disliked each other. And that was just from reading stuff about each other and hearing stuff on the grapevine. When we actually met, we realised we were really good friends, and we've been friends ever since. And he's going through a particularly tough time at the moment, so that's why he's in. One of the most underrated riders ever, you know, and to retire so young as he did and walk away was just like, I don't know. At the time, you think it's a waste of talent, but, you know, looking at me now and Lee Adams and Golub and people like that, like maybe he did the fucking right thing, you know?
Yeah.
But hey-ho.
Hey-ho. And last one, then?
Last one, going to have to be Mark, isn't it? Mark Loram.
Yeah, another Bradford teammate of yours.
Yes. Yeah. And another guy I've known from junior grass track, probably met when we were, probably when I was a teenager and he was 10 or 11, I would have thought.
Wow, it's a long time. Yeah.
We've been friends ever since as well. All the lads who grew up on the grass of our generation pretty much are all still mates. Stoney, Screeny, me, Mark, Chris Louis, there's probably loads more as well. I can think about Sean Wilson, Paul Thorpe. Well, we're not mates with him anymore, but hey.
Right.
Well, there was a big load of us who grew up at the same time now.
Yeah, grass track was a big scene, wasn't it? I know a lot of
riders
came through
that. There was no junior speedway then, you know, which was a bit of a bummer, really, when you think about it. Because we did one speedway meet in the year, and that was on Bellevue Hyde Road.
Mm.
And I used to look forward to it so much because it was like going from a bumpy, horrible field to this speedway track, which was like a billiard table. Yeah. There wasn't a ripple on it. It was just amazing. I was like, fuck grass track, I want to be a speedway rider.
Mind made up.
Yep.
Okay, so that's your 1-7, an awesome team there. I don't think anybody's going to argue with that.
No.
Best referee, then, or your favourite referee, if there is one?
Of the current of the current crop, the only one is Dave Robinson.
Dave Robinson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the older brigade, Paul Ackroyd was a good ref. He did my testimonial at Bradford for me, and we've been friends ever since. And funnily enough, I actually used to have no problem at all with the one everybody hated. What was he called? Oh, he was dead strict.
Frank?
Frank Ebden.
Yeah.
See, I had no problem with Frank Ebden because Frank was like, the rules are, you don't roll at the start. If you roll at the start, you'll get a one, and then if you keep rolling at the start, you'll get a fucking fine. See, that was great to me with Frank. Rules were the rules, and you know where he stood. It was only the people who were trying to get cheap that I never had a problem with Frank because I used to sit still at the start. It was the rollers that used to have a problem with Frank. He used to get the fucking rollers, you know what I mean? But rolls were, you're not supposed to roll, so why not?
Yeah, when I did the one with Shane Parker, he said that Frank Ebden would definitely not be refereeing his.
I think
he had a problem with Frank because he got through the meeting so quick.
Everybody had a problem with Frank. Everybody had a problem with Frank. But like I say, I never had a problem with Frank because most of the time he was always down south. And the fact that he got the meetings over quick, that was all right because we had so fucking far to go home. You know what I mean? We didn't mind that.
If you were going to change one rule, what would it be?
God.
Anyway.
I would install myself as Speedway Tsar and solve all the fucking problems.
Speedway Tsar Gary Havelock is in command of the sport. That's great. That's a good way of looking at it because you get to change lots of rules with just the one there. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Great. And if we're going to pick one team, any team from all time to race against your All-Star 1-7, what would that be? Which team, which year?
Oh, God. I'd have to say the England touring team, the last England touring team that went to Australia, all those lads. We beat the Aussies 5-2, five test matches to two. And it should have been 6-1 because they cheated in the first one. So, yeah, I put that team.
Wow.
England Lions.
The England Lions as the opposition at Bradford, with the Roslav facilities.
That's it.
I'm sure it'd be a great meeting. Well, thanks very much, Gary, for taking the time and speaking to us. It's been great. And
no problem, Ian. I hope the people enjoy my tales. They were all the good ones that I could repeat. You'll have to do it after 9 o'clock one someday.
We'll have to do one in.
Did you see that one they did with the comedians where they got them drunk? I'll tell you what, like ex speed riders get them drunk, you'd get some absolute crackers.
Maybe one for future. I'll get the lawyers on standby. Gary Havelock, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and thanks for joining us on this episode of Humans of Speedway.
All right, mate. No problem. You take care.
My thanks to Gary Havelock for joining us on this episode of Humans of Speedway. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed chatting to him. It was sort of a bit of a fanboy experience, really, for me. But it was great chatting with Gary, and hopefully we'll see him back around the tracks next season in his new role as being sort of assistant manager for Pool. Don't forget, if you're new to Humans of Speedway, well, first of all, welcome along. We have plenty other episodes for you to check out. In fact, there are 11 by my reckoning. We've got chats with Phil Morris, the race director for the Speedway Grand Prix and Speedway of Nations series. How about a trip inside the referee's box with Chris Durno, talking about what they get up to. Shane Parker, Peter Oakes, Neil Machin, Nigel Pearson, Scott Nichols, among some of the names that you can check out chats with in our series. And if you want to get in touch, then please do as well. You can drop us a line through social media. On Facebook, you just search for Humans of Speedway. And we're on Twitter at Speedway Humans. Is the place to go. Follow us there to get preview clips and find out all the news of upcoming episodes and stuff like that first. Of course, if you have enjoyed it, the best thing that you can do is just tell your friends who are also Speedway fans as well, if they might enjoy it. Spread the word, maybe give us a rating and a review too, wherever you get your podcast. That would also be amazing. And we'll speak to you next time on the next edition of Humans of Speedway.